From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the United States confirms it's supplying arms to Kurdish forces in northern Iraq to support their military efforts against the surge of Islamic State fighters.
We are working with the government of Iraq to accelerate deliveries of badly needed arms to Kurdish forces in the north.
Also today, Israeli and Palestinian officials resume indirect talks in Egypt to bring an end to the Gaza bloodshed. And California embraces a centuries-old Chinese game of skill, strategy, and a sprinkling of luck.
When Monday comes, they don't call us and they don't ask us to help out. I think we really enjoy the Mahjong because of the camaraderie. But beyond that, I think Mahjong is a competitive game. We like to win.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Iraq's president has named a new prime minister to end the 8-year term of Nouri al-Maliki, who is so far refusing to step down, deploying special forces to protect his tenure. U.S. President Barack Obama congratulated Haidar al-Abadi, who was named by President Fouad Masoum to replace him.
As I said when I authorized these operations, there is no American military solution to the larger crisis in Iraq. The only lasting solution is for Iraqis to come together and form an inclusive government, one that represents the legitimate interests of all Iraqis, and one that can unify the country's fight against ISIL.
The U.S. has reportedly begun providing weapons to Kurdish forces in a bid to push back Islamic State militants in northern Iraq. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Reports the Obama administration is now sending weapons to Kurdish forces underscores the level of concern here in Washington over their vulnerability. The U.S. State Department will only say that the Kurds are getting arms from a number of different sources and that they're being rearmed. The White House is repeatedly insisting that Iraqis must solve their own security problems. The U.S. military has in previous days been helping with weapons deliveries from the Iraqis to the Kurds, including logistics and transportation.
Indirect talks between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators have started in Cairo, aimed at bringing an end to the conflict in Gaza. The fresh talks, brokered by Egypt, come during another 3-day ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Some 2,000 people have died since the latest round of fighting began on the 8th of July. But Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev says the violence must stop before negotiations can begin.
We're a democracy, we're a free country, and we're acting to protect our people. And Hamas is a terrorist group, extremist Islamist, very radical, very cutthroat. The violence must stop. And if Hamas doesn't stop the violence, so these talks will stop.
In eastern Ukraine, over 100 prison inmates have escaped after 5 artillery shells hit a high-security prison nearby Donetsk, creating a riot. One prisoner was killed, while 5 other inmates and 2 guards were injured when the shells hit. Daria Bandarchuk reports from Moscow.
Ukraine's prison service says 34 inmates have been returned to the prison and they are trying to track down the others. Ukrainian artillery has been shelling the city's outskirts as part of an operation to push out pro-Russian militants from the area. Fighting started in April when the militants seized government buildings across eastern Ukraine. Hundreds of thousands of civilians have reportedly fled the area. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The European Union is setting up a task force to assess the impact of the Russian ban on food imports from the EU. Moscow banned the import of EU and US food last week, citing health concerns as the reason, but it's been widely received as a retaliatory measure to Western sanctions imposed on Russia over their actions in Ukraine. Jack Pirak reports.
The European Commission says it will react in a proportionate and rapid way to the food import ban by Moscow. Around 10% of EU agricultural exports go to Russia, amounting to roughly 11 billion euros of trade per year. Poland says it will file a complaint to the World Trade Organization over the embargo, as may the European Commission over the ban on EU pork. Despite calls from countries like Bulgaria, an emergency meeting of agricultural ministers has not been called. However, national experts from across the 28 member states, as well as commission officials, will meet in Brussels Thursday. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
And at a federal trial in New York City this week, lawyers representing Americans killed or injured in terrorist attacks will seek millions of dollars from the Jordanian bank they say funneled money to the group responsible. Arab Bank will face a jury over claims it knowingly provided material support and services to the terrorist group Hamas. Lawyers say this is the first terrorism financing case against a bank to go to trial in the U.S. Patrice Howard reports from New York.
Arab Bank claims it did not knowingly serve the extremist group, but plaintiffs will argue that the bank facilitated the distribution of funds to terrorists and their families after violent attacks. A family of one suicide bomber reportedly received the equivalent of over $5,000 by simply showing proof of identity. The almost 300 U.S. citizens who were victims or family of victims of terrorist attacks committed by Hamas between 2001 and 2004 sued the bank and will now seek compensation. Patrice Howard, New York.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
We are working with the government of Iraq to accelerate deliveries of badly needed arms to Kurdish forces in the north.
State Department spokesperson Marie Harve confirming that the U.S. was supplying arms to Kurdish forces in northern Iraq as they battle against Islamic State fighters. This comes as Iraq's president pushes for a new prime minister to help bring peace and stability to the country as it fights against the grip of the brutal IS insurgency. President Fuad Masum has nominated the deputy prime minister for the top job. However, the current PM, Nouri al-Maliki, is determined to hang on to his seat for a third term. The reports came as Secretary of State John Kerry said the process of forming a new government was critical for stability in Iraq.
The government formation process is critical in terms of sustaining the stability and calm in Iraq. And our hope is that Mr. Maliki will not stir those waters.
Airstrikes from U.S. warplanes continued against IS targets over the weekend as the humanitarian crisis in the regions attacked by the jihadists worsened. The Pentagon has conceded that while limited strikes have gone some way towards strengthening Kurdish security forces, the threat remains critical.
Well, in terms of time, we have afforded a little bit more time to the crisis just with the success of our humanitarian assistance thus far. But the urgency of the crisis has not gone away, and it is very important that we find a solution for those that are stranded up there.
Vladimir Van Wilgenberg is a journalist and expert on Iraq affairs and is currently in Erbil, the regional capital of Iraqi Kurdistan.
Initially, the Kurds were a little bit worried when ISIS was able to take two cities, 50 miles outside of Erbil. And also when they took over a lot of Christian areas in the Mosul province. But after the U.S. started their airstrikes, I think around Friday and Saturday, the Kurds, they managed to push back the ISIS yesterday from the towns of Mahmud and Gwer. So now the mood has really changed, and I just talked on the front, close to the front line with a security commander or security leader. And he said that the U.S. air support was really detrimental to the Kurdish success against the ISIS to push them back.
And now we're hearing reports that the U.S. is directly arming the Kurdish Peshmerga forces. Do you have any detail on that? Do we know what exactly is being supplied in terms of weaponry and how much benefit that will be to the fight against the Islamic State forces?
Well, it's very unclear what kind of weapons they are supplying, because initially the Kurds, they mostly have Kalashnikov and older weapons, although I have seen some American weapons on the front lines. So all these Kalashnikovs are probably they're in the need actually of a lot of ammunition, and they're also in need of anti-tank weapons and night goggles and other equipment, but so far I haven't seen a lot of proof of American weapons going to the Kurds. So I think or we don't see them because they're exactly at the front line with the ISIS, or it's just a slow process and it's going step by step.
Is there a sense that the United States military operation is enough? President Obama has said from the start there will be no US military solution to this crisis. There is also pressure from some experts who say, defense analysts who say, this fight cannot be won without boots on the ground.
Well, the Kurdish president, Barzani, said that they don't need boots on the ground to solve this issue because they can fight. The only thing they need is assistance. So I think the issue can be solved, but they need to be Iraqi government, a functioning Iraqi government in Baghdad, which is quite difficult. We are seeing that the current situation now with the Prime Minister Maliki and the Shia Alliance announcing another candidate. So I think if there's an Iraqi government in Baghdad, which is unites the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shia and all of them, they start to work together, it would be much more easier to have boots on the ground, and then they just need American assistance or Western assistance, military advisors, special forces, ammunition. They need help with the U.S. Air Force. They need to have their own air force to do that. So I think that's the main problem for the Iraqi government, but also for the Kurdish government, is that they have boots on the ground, but they just need assistance, basically.
Is there a sense that the formation of a new government will actually have, in the short term, any sort of impact on this ISIS threat?
Well, I'm not sure about it. It really depends on who you ask. But it's for sure that a lot of people probably will think if a united government is what we'd be able better to deal with the current crisis rather than these, you know, like Sunni politicians opposing the government and then the Kurds having their own problems with the government. But there's a lot of outstanding issues to be solved. But even if they form a government, it is still the main problems are not solved yet. For instance, what are they going to do with the disputed areas? How are they going to fight the Islamic State? How are they going to include the Sunnis in the process? How are they going to capture those areas back which were captured by the Islamic State? How they are going to reorganize the Iraqi army? So still, even if the new Iraqi prime minister is elected, then it's still going to be quite a long process, I think.
And Vladimir, can you give us an update on the humanitarian aid effort for those people who fleeing persecution, literally running for their lives from the IS fighters, how they're bearing up on top of that mountain, the Yazidis in their thousands, short on water and food and medical assistance. What's the situation there?
Well, it was unsuspected situation. So I think slowly it's picking up the assistance. You know, we have seen the British Air Force dropping humanitarian supplies. We've seen U.S. dropping supplies. The U.N. is now starting to getting in full action now. So slowly things are being set up to help those displaced people. But the problem is there are so many, and I just talked to a Kurdish official, and he said the problem is we need to provide those people with services, with electricity, with water, with shelter, and there are so many of them.
Journalist Vladimir van Wilgenberg in Erbil, northern Iraq. This is FSN Reports. Israeli negotiators are back in Cairo to continue indirect talks towards achieving a ceasefire in the ongoing Gaza conflict. Egypt is mediating the talks. The latest 72-hour truce between Israeli forces and Hamas militants appears to be holding, although Hamas confirmed firing rockets towards Israel just minutes before it came into force. LBC's Julia Hartley-Brewer spoke to Seth J. Frantzman, a journalist with the Jerusalem Post in Jerusalem, but began by asking Daoud Kitab, an award-winning Palestinian journalist in Amman, Jordan, if this latest truce will hold.
The question is not so much the ceasefire as much as the Israelis giving up their unacceptable siege on Gaza. That's really what's been holding up the whole situation. Palestinians say they have a right. Not every Palestinian is Hamas or Fatah, and they have a right to move around. They have the right to eat. They have the right to have cement, to rebuild their houses, and they have to have a right to enjoy normal life, to go to the West Bank, to go to Jerusalem, to go anywhere in the world.
Indeed, but this is the issue, isn't it, about getting both sides to agree to points which they've already said publicly and privately they will never agree to. The Israelis say they will not allow allow free passage of the Palestinian people into and out of Gaza, and indeed won't stop the siege of preventing goods, whether it be arms or whether it be cement and other things going into Gaza. So what hope is there that we can actually get some sort of deal on the table?
I think there is hope if the world is united behind the natural rights of people to live in freedom. The occupation continues in Gaza and the West Bank against international law, and that has to end. So any way you look at it, there has to be an end to the siege and to the occupation. You cannot just look at the results. You have to look at the root causes. The root cause is the occupation, and the root cause of the current stalemate, if you will, is the siege on Gaza that's been going on for 7 years.
Seth J. Frantzman, if I could turn to you now. He's a journalist with the Jerusalem Post in Jerusalem. In terms of the view from Israel, what hope is there going to be? Because the Israeli government, as Benjamin Netanyahu has made it very clear, that the Israeli government will not agree to allow open borders with Gaza, won't end the siege. And at the same time, we've got Hamas basically saying that they won't ever recognise Israel's right to exist, etc. We are in a bit of a stalemate. Is there any hope?
I mean, I think you've characterized it very well, because we see that there's no possibility, I think, in the playbook at the moment for the siege to be lifted in any way, shape, or form, because unless there is some sort of a security guarantee that Israel has, there doesn't seem to be a vision that can happen. Whether it's a sea route, as the Europeans have proposed to Cyprus, or for the Egyptian crossing, which, of course, the Egyptians control, so it's probably up to Egypt. And that's a big impasse. I think the other impasse we see is that Hamas thinks it has basically won the current round of fighting. And if you follow what their statements are, or even their Twitter feed, where they say, you know, that this resistance is just waiting for the next round, it's not clear what their incentive is to come to an agreement. And it's not clear what Israel's incentive is either. And without an incentive, then it seems to me it's basically a stalemate with a series of maybe small ceasefires coming up.
Is there any argument, I'll put this to you, Seth, first, but also I'd love to get Dawood's input on this as well, for some sort of UN-backed force to go in and basically take over security of this entire area? I mean, I'm not sure anyone's putting this on the table as an option, but in terms of the absolutely implacability of both sides to actually come to some sort of agreement while the rest of the world just sort of watches on in horror, and regardless of whether someone is Palestinian or Israeli, innocent civilians dying on both sides, regardless of which numbers on both sides, is a totally, you know, a horror for everyone to watch, and particularly for their families and friends. Is there a case for the UN to authorise some sort of UN force to go in as a peacekeeping force to sort things out?
I mean, there may be a case to be made, but that would have to be made by the EU or the Arab League or the US. And as I think we all realise,
it's not going to happen.
The United States would never accept that, and most European countries would not be in favour. And even some of the Arab countries would not
that's
want
true.
This precedent. I don't think they would like true. The UN in Iraq or some of these places.
So indeed. So Dawood, what do you want to say, Dawood?
Yeah. I think it's true. The only ones who are against any international interference is the Israelis. The idea of bringing international forces between the occupiers and the occupied is an idea that Palestinians and Arabs and most of the world accepts. The Israelis say, no way. The Israelis say, we don't trust the UN. We don't want the American. The Palestinians said, let's bring American soldiers. And the Americans are open to it, or NATO soldiers. The Israelis said, we don't want Americans to die for us. We can defend ourselves. It's the Israelis who are against any internationalization of the conflict as a step towards independence. We agree that there has to be a gradual move. We have two, you know, let's say, boxers that are in the 200th round. Both of them are tired. We need somebody to come in between both of us.
LBC's Julia Hartley Brewer with Seth J. Frantzman, a journalist with the Jerusalem Post, and Dawood Kutab, an award-winning Palestinian journalist based in Jordan. Now, many people who've travelled in Asia may have seen the centuries-old Chinese game of Mahjong being played in parks and squares. But few may realise that from the 1920s to the 1960s, the mythical game was also wildly popular in the United States, where many Jewish American families played it at home. Mahjong has experienced something of a resurgence in the past two decades, with new players from Chinese and other communities joining its legion of fans. So-called Maj clubs have been springing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, from where Rebecca Bowring reports.
click of coloured tiles echoes through a suburban home in Mountain View, California, all day long. Once a week, four women meet to play mahjong, meaning sparrows, a game of skill, strategy, and a sprinkling of luck. This is the 16-tile Taiwan version. Players must collect five sets of three and a pair in patterns similar to gin rummy. Geraldine Huang says on a Monday, the women's children know they're busy.
When Monday comes, they don't call us and they don't ask us to help out. I think we really enjoy the mahjong because of the camaraderie. But beyond that, I think mahjong is a competitive game. We like to win.
Huang's been playing mahjong for more than four decades. The game's experienced a revival in recent years. Today, thousands of non-Chinese people play it, both young and old.
In a mahjong set, there's three suits.
At 35, Sarah Linden is the Bay Area's youngest mahjong teacher. She picked up the game as a teenager and has set up a local mahjong club.
Three of a kind. Three dot tiles.
The American version she's teaching has a rule card reprinted annually and eight additional joker tiles.
It adds more luck to the game because if you're lucky to pick jokers, you have more chances to get closer to your winning hand.
Mahjong has long been beloved by the American Jewish community. An exhibition at the Contemporary Jewish Museum reveals how the craze caught on when mahjong first arrived in the U.S. in the 1920s, most likely via San Francisco. Photos and artifacts, including mahjong travel sets and vintage tiles, chronicle the game's evolution as a post-war social activity, even played at the swimming pool. Its elegance and exotic roots in Chinese royalty made it an instant hit with upper-class sophisticates. Laurie Starr is executive director of the Contemporary Jewish Museum.
It was a wonderful way for mothers and daughters, mothers and aunts, grandmothers and granddaughters to connect generation to generation. And it also allowed for people to feel at home with one another in America.
Mahjong marathons have gone on across the U.S. for nearly a century and look set to endure. Geraldine Huang says her children haven't had time to learn the game, but hopes it will skip a generation.
My aim is to teach the Chinese culture through mahjong to my grandchildren.
Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, if you glanced at the New York Times business section this morning, you will have seen that there is a lot of buzz out there about a website called BuzzFeed. It is, in fact, now far more than a website, and it's just secured $50 million in fresh Silicon Valley investment in a bid to broaden its offerings, and particularly to deepen its production of video. In his downtime, of which there cannot be much, BuzzFeed's co-founder and CEO Jonah Peretti has produced a new book alongside the Brooklyn-based artist Corey Archangel. It's called Working on My Novel, and it's a compilation of tweets in which that phrase is used. The two men talked with Ian Steadman of Britain's New Statesman magazine, and Jonah Peretti kicks things off.
It was a period of buzz. We were in a little office in Chinatown in New York, and we had, I don't know, maybe a dozen people, and it was really a lab. And the reason Corey was in the office was that I would just find interesting friends and say, hey, you want to come one day a week and post on BuzzFeed? And Corey was one of the friends who took me up on it.
And why specifically working on my novel? Were you distracted trying to work on a novel at the time?
Well,
it's funny laughing at people who were distracting themselves on Twitter.
Twitter was like, it was 2009, so actually Twitter was, it wasn't like brand new, but it was new-ish in culture, mm-hmm. And I was just trying to wrap my head around it, because you remember that was, and Jonah, am I right, like that was still the era of the blog, I think?
Yeah, blogging was still big, you know, Facebook was a simple social network, it didn't have any content on it, it was just a way to connect with your friends. Twitter was a lot smaller. And I think, it, you know, in terms of watching Corey over the years, he often plays with things and gets an idea and then does something many years later with the idea. Like if the idea sticks with him for 5 years, then it's probably a pretty good idea, and he should do something. So I think this is another example of that with this book, which is, it wasn't like he thought of it and just did it the next week and said, oh, like, this is an easy idea, I'll just like round up a bunch of tweets and have a book. This was something that he'd been thinking about for many years.
5 years from beginning till end. So what Jonah was saying, basically all of a sudden we had like micro, like people were just tweeting sentences, and that was a new thing. And so I was trying to figure out like, well, what is it? I mean, it's hard to remember. It's hard to even think about now, but like what does it mean that that's new? And then of course it seemed perfectly obvious to contrast it to the novel, right? I mean, that was like the first thing that came to my head.
It seems like a really funny rejoinder to the, at the moment there's a lot of discussion about the idea of using things like Twitter for 21st century fiction, kind of the novelist David Mitchell, for instance, is tweeting out stage by stage bits of his new novel, and this just seems like a really funny kind of response to that.
I don't know if it's a response, but I definitely think of it as a novel, like a novel, and it's fiction. We've decided that it was fiction because we had a long conversation, and we purposely made it like in the, you know, the Penguin default novel template. Yeah. So it really feels like a novel. It smells like a novel. But, you know, I do really think of it as like a real book, you know?
Yeah. When you had that long conversation about why it's a novel, do you think it has a narrative, for instance, even though it's just a series of tweets?
Well, actually, the long conversation at Penguin was whether it was fiction or nonfiction. Because we could have really went either way, I think, but fiction to me seemed more poetic, you know? But on my end, yeah, there is a narrative. If you have the book, there are these kind of like tea kettle drawings in it, and those kind of serve as the chapter markers between different sections.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of like chill section. There's a kind of culture section where people are talking about the kind of culture that they surround themselves while writing the novel. There's a kind of punchline section, which is the section that just says working on my novel, page after page. There is a desperation section where people are getting really stressed out. You know what I mean? And then there's a triumph section, which is what the book ends up. The book kind of ends on a high note, kind of creative triumph.
Well, I would say the book itself is a triumph, a literary triumph.
I think you said something. So, yeah. And it's,
The other thing I find so interesting is that so much of the interesting things that have emerged on the web have come out of procrastination. Like, and I think it's probably true in art as well, but I mean, my whole career is based on procrastinating writing my master's thesis and discovering accidentally sort of the viral web. And I think the sort of relationship between procrastination and doing meaningful work is pretty interesting right now, and it's sometimes the things that people dismiss the most are actually some of the most valuable generative kinds of activities.
Jonah Peretti, the co-founder and CEO of BuzzFeed, who had a very big day today. He and Corey Archangel were talking to Ian Steadman of Britain's New Statesman, and more of that interview can be found on the New Statesman's website, newstatesman.com. The book, Working on My Novel, is published by Penguin Global. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact the programme, you can email us reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.